Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members, and administrative staff. First of all, we're here on behalf of the Red Lake Public School Independent School District Number 38. Mr. Chairman, committee members, we'd like to acknowledge our school board members. We have some representatives of council and school administrative staff, and our superintendent of schools, Mr. Stuart DeJarling. As you know, we've been preparing and doing a lot of work over the last 2 years of working with your committees and the other committees within the legislative body, along with the State Department of Education, State Department of Finance, and State Department of Administration. For our session this afternoon, Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'd like to start with our Superintendent of Schools, Mr. Stuart DeJarling, to give his presentation and to the committee, and we'll, if it's all right, we'll go from there.
Absolutely.
Well, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the Capital Investment Committee. I'm Superintendent of Red Lake School District Number 38 in Northern Minnesota, and I have been before the Capital Investment Committee at least three times now within the last three bonding phases. We started out in the year 2000, we're back in 2002, and then we're back again this year. We originally requested $37.1 million back in 2002 as a funding bill for innovative building projects within a Red Lake School District. In this year's bonding, governor's bonding request, the governor recommended $22.1 million for a new middle school at Red Lake. We are happy that, you know, the governor recommended this. But we had put in for a capital loan of $33.1 million. And as we come before this committee and Education Finance Committee with the $33.1 million on the table that we had approved. We're happy that, you know, that we get the time to present our information on why, you know, we would like the Capital Investment Committee to reconsider, you know, the amount that they're recommending that go forward, which is 16.7. Throughout the years, the last 3 years, Red Lake School District has made significant advances in building projects, curriculum development, and in general, the enrollment of students coming home. Last year, we had a $12.6 million bonding bill approved, and we're wrapping up this summer at the high school. And as part of this bonding bill, we had $500,000 designated to begin a detailed plan that addressed the Red Lake School District, a master plan. And we met with tribal officials, parents, students, teachers, veterans organizations to get this plan together. And after many meetings, we submitted a master plan to the Department of Finance and Revenue. And we were online for 15 years up to the year 2013 with this plan. And we'd like to hold on to this plan because, number one, you know, it was designated as a from the part of the capital loan last year that we got, that we come up with a plan. And it's also, you know, that Department of Finance, Department of the Minnesota Department of Education wanted to see what our outlooks were for the future in building. We need to look at not providing to our students and to the Red Lake School District, you know, piecemeal bonding bills. And that's what we've been getting the last 2 years. We came in at $37.1 million 2 years ago, and we got 12. We come in last year, and we got 12 again. And we followed the advice of, you know, the finance, K-12 bonding, education finance. We followed the advice of Department of Revenue, Department of Finance, Minnesota Department of Education. We all followed their advice in submitting, you know, for the school district a long-range plan. And we want to hold on to that plan, because if we don't, then, you know, the $500,000 that we were given last year, you know, kind of is nil now, because if we go with 16.7, which is you know, we have to cut back into our master plan here, and we have two folders that outline our master plan that we developed for the next 15 years till 2013. And it's a plan that addresses, you know, it's the first time a plan has ever been developed within the Red Lake School District that addresses building plans. And we'd like to stick with that. We'd like to stick on that plan there. Because if we don't, you know, we'll be back next year. We'll be back at the next bonding phase, asking for more money, asking for money to continue on our building project. There was mention in the Education Finance Committee about a fund balance that the Red Lake School District had. And yes, we do have a good fund balance. And this is due to good financial management within the district, something that the Minnesota Department of Education, Department of Finance and Revenue, that they look at, that, you know, every school district in Minnesota, you know, their fund balance, their financial management plans are all checked and audited. And yes, we do have a good financial plan in place. And within this surplus that we have within the district, we have money designated to continue operation of the school district in case of an emergency or something that arises. We have a three month designation out of that reserve to continue to provide educational services to our kids on the Red Lake Nation. We also have within the emergencies, like, we've had a lot of problems with mold. Last year we lost almost 10 school days because of mold problem in the buildings that we're trying to replace right now. And we're still using those buildings. We've been very fortunate not to have any problems this year with the mold problem. But the master plan addresses that. And we have put in with this bonding issue some renovations at the high school. And that was excluded right now. We have a new middle school. The renovations at the high school were to handle the mold problem. Once we get the completion of that phase, the problems that with the building that we were having problems with were going to be demolished. And if, you know, we get 16.7 that is designated right now, we have to hold off on that. And like I said, we lost 10 school days last year because of mold problems within that old 1949 addition that we had. I was walking through a middle school yesterday. One of the things I told my friend that I was walking with, I said, I went to school in the first grade, and I pointed to the classroom. And that was in 1956. That's when that new elementary was opened. The one that the middle school is in now. And he couldn't believe it, because they're, you know, almost 50 years later. I still have kids going into a school that is built for an elementary kids. I have middle school kids going in there right now. I have crowded halls. I have crowded classrooms. And we all know, with crowded halls and crowded classrooms, it leads to additional problems. Fights, discipline problems, attendance problems. And we're trying to address that at the Red Lake School District. And we have addressed it. And we're glad to say we're making progress with that. But one of the first things, you know, we need to show our kids is that they're appreciated. And we appreciate you by providing you good buildings to come to school in. Our early childhood center, which went up 2 years ago, provides an excellent opportunity for kids to come in. We're busting at the seams with kindergarten kids, because they have a nice building. They got a nice gym. They have clean halls. They got fantastic technology in those buildings. And our elementary also, we have very good technology plans in there. We have a good report. We continue to work with Panema School, Elementary School. We completed an addition last fall and on the phase two of that. And attendance in Panema has gone up dramatically because because of the new buildings. We asked the Capital Investment Committee to look at our the progress that we have made in the Red Lake School District and the building request that we have on the table before you at this time. We ask that you look at our master plan, a plan that came out of committees last year, came out of the capital capital loan request. We've jumped through the hoops. Everything that's been asked for, this is a, we provided, we've met, we've tried to change. This is the seventh week Monty and I have been here. 7 weeks in a row we've been here. Before various committees, meeting with the Department of Revenue. We are very committed in seeking, you know, the full amount of 33.1. You ask, what's in it for the state of Minnesota? 10 years from now, you'll have more Red Lake students graduating. You'll have more programs in the buildings because with more space, we can offer more programs. You'll have less people on welfare, more people going on to vocational and college. This 33.1 million, if approved, if recommended, 10 years, 15 years from now would seem just a small amount compared to what it would bring in the future in educational advances within the Red Lake Nation and the Red Lake School District. There was mention on square footage. Square footage. It's easy to walk around the corner in Minneapolis and get a concrete company come in and bring cement blocks, or a lumber company to come in and bring lumber within the metropolitan area. Red Lake is 35 miles from the furthest concrete company in Bemidji. Round trip to that is 70 miles. Over in Panema, it's double that to take concrete to Panema, to take lumber, to take all the construction equipment. And we are charged for that. Yes, our square footage does seem high because of our proximity and our locality of the Red Lake Nation. We're not isolated, but we're pretty far away from the companies that provide these supplies, these construction supplies, this concrete and the workers. So we ask you again, to look at that. Look at where the Red Lake School District is. Time and time again, we've asked our teachers, what's one of the main things that you want completed? What's one of the main things you want? And they all say buildings. We need adequate buildings, especially within the middle school and high school, because that's where our kids come from, the elementary. And when they walk, some of the members have been to Red Lake. I don't know if you've been invited. I know other committees, we've entertained visits. Senator Scola has been up there. Doug Lindgren has been up there. Representative Knobloch has been up there. And they've seen the elementary, the middle school. They've seen the halls. They've seen the condition of that building. And all we ask is, on behalf of the Red Lake School District, and the students and the staff, that we ask that you recommend 33.1 to help us, continue our plan, the plans that we have, the master plan that we have for our district. Thank you.
Questions for the superintendent? I can obviously understand your frustration when you come here with a plan, obviously several phases of what is needed to put these buildings in good condition, and obviously to deal with a growing student population. But as you well know, that's it happens across the board here. Different requests meet with either reduced amounts of funding, get vetoed by the governor, all sorts of things in this process. My question would be to, if the appropriation was at the a reduced amount, what then do you do? I mean, is it do you feel the entire project has to be rescaled? Do you delay doing anything? What is your best guess as to what would happen if you didn't receive the $31 million?
Well, we have talked about number one. You know, our stats is, you know, we recommended, you know, we asked for $33.1 million. We have met and you know, went through a couple scenarios on, you know, what would happen if we got lower, if and we did, you know, we have addressed that, not officially, you know, it's not officially in writing, you know, but to the board of education and our architects, our construction company, and our Hammett consulting company. Company have, you know, we've all sat down and said, well, what if we get this amount, you know? We have a
okay.
Not on paper, though, not officially, we haven't.
But you've at least discussed what the alternatives might be as difficult as that situation obviously is.
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, maybe just a further note on that. Go back to what Superintendent Jarley mentioned 2 years ago. The Department of CFL at that time approved the $40.1 million. We ended up with $12.1. We make it work, and we'll do the same with whatever the dollar amount is. But we'd like to stick, as the superintendent said, as close as we can. And this idea come from your committees last year of the doing the master plan and putting in. And I think that this master plan, even we went a couple of steps beyond putting in cost per square foot, and we did the financial projections for the district up to 2013 also. So there's been a lot of work done, and hopefully it'll help the committees.
Representative Kelleher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If the superintendent just briefly could address, I was reading the documentation about graduation rates, and clearly this is something that we struggle with statewide for Native people, and you have a goal of increasing graduation rates by 75%. Tell us how the buildings and the facilities help you do that.
With newer buildings, you know, comes newer technology plans, better media centers, more reference material. Right now, last year, we graduated 59 students. That was our highest graduation class in history. Right now, we're looking at about 66 for this year. When the kids see, you know, that, they got good computers, they got good books, they got teachers that care for them, they got classrooms that, you know, they can go in and, you know, they don't have to worry about, am I going to be here tomorrow because the school is closed because of, you know, mold problem or an old boiler that's been there since the building was built back in 56 in the middle school? We had problems with that. Students also look at, I think it's a pride. Red Lake Warriors, you know, we've been to the state tournament the last 5 out of 6 years. And that brings to the students and to the community a great sense of pride that I'm glad to be the students, you know, the students are saying I'm glad to be a Red Lake High School student or a student within the school district, and I'm coming to school. They've seen a turnaround in attitudes. You know, we're still working with teacher attitudes. But they've seen, you know, they've seen progress with that. Their voice is heard, and through their voice being heard, you know, more kids are coming back. We this last quarter, we just got 10 more coming in from other school districts, returning to Red Lake, which is our goal, to bring them all home.
Representative Kelleher?
Thank you.
Are there any further questions for Mr. Hammett or the superintendent?
Mr. Chairman, I think for just a follow-up question to Representative's concern in terms of graduation. I'd like to go back and for the committee to, I think, understand what all this means in terms of folks at Red Light. 1993, we opened our elementary school, a new elementary. Last year, we had to add two rooms onto that, four rooms onto our early childhood with the number of students we got. It has taken us about 9 years to be able to get everything into full swing in the school district, and I think they've done a marvelous job. Last year, they made the 3-star in academics and in mathematics. This is what we strive to get done. This is what we want to see done for our, for our, all of our students, not just the elementary.
Yep. Okay. We appreciate your testimony, and thank you for being here, and we hope that we can, as we move along, we'll be taking up and looking at this project in depth.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for being here.
Committee members.
Okay, moving on. Our next area of discussion will be in the higher education area. Mr. Don Gearhart, I believe, is coming forward to testify on the U of M Mayo Clinic projects and the Minsky medical projects. Mr. Gearhart, if you'd, for the record, state your name and who you represent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Don Gearhart. I'm the CEO of Medical Alley, a trade association based here in Minnesota.
Thank you. Proceed.
Thank you. Again, I'm the CEO of Medical Alley, a Minnesota-based trade association, and I'm here today to speak in support of the University of Minnesota Mayo Clinic Research Facility funding and also to speak in support of funding for higher education. Medical Alley, again, is a Minnesota trade association representing approximately 400 member organizations, including medical device manufacturers, bioscience, hospital and clinic, pharmaceutical, and many other companies participating in healthcare. Our member organizations employ approximately 250,000 Minnesotans. Minnesota's Medical Alley is home to 520 FDA-approved medical manufacturing organizations or companies. These medical technology manufacturing industry members maintain approximately 50,000 jobs in the state with an average salary of about $56,000 in 2002. Medical innovation has been a major source for increases in manufacturing jobs in Minnesota over the last 2 years. In fact, we think it is the major source, but we can't specifically identify that. During the 1990s, there was a 56% increase in these medical technology manufacturing jobs in Minnesota, making Minnesota the second highest increasing state in the nation, second only to California in that class of jobs. During the last few weeks, three of the largest medical technology manufacturers, Guidant, Boston Scientific, and Medtronic, recently announced that they will, in aggregate, grow 8,000 to 10,000 jobs in Minnesota during the next 3 to 7 years, more than likely about 5 years. These three companies together, just three out of the 520, will produce approximately $500 million new job dollars per year in Minnesota. The growth of this industry in Minnesota has been uniquely tied to the research capabilities of the University of Minnesota. A visit to the lobby product history displays of Medtronic and St. Jude will verify the importance of the University of Minnesota's research and education to our medical technology sector. Medical Alley has been very supportive of the increased funding for the Academic Health Center and the Translational Research Facility. All of us at Medical Alley thank the legislature for its support of that funding. Medical Alley supports public research and workforce development through higher education as the way to create the miracles of tomorrow and keep Minnesota economically strong. In the last 2 weeks, I've had personal conversation with either the CEO or the senior vice president of the four largest medical technology manufacturers, and I've asked them why they've chosen Minnesota for their major expansion, both in research and in manufacturing. To a person, these were separate discussions. To a person, the words have been, it's because of the people. Smart, well-trained, well-educated, hard-working, and because of the ideas. the research and ideas coming out of Minnesota. In fact, the people from Boston Scientific now told me literally 2 weeks ago that they think that what's coming out of here right now is the best in the world. We need to protect that. So we're pleased that the governor did recommend funding several important initiatives to Medical Alley members: the University Mayo Clinic Bioscience Initiative, the Life Science Building at Duluth, the Pharmacy and Biology Building, the Science Building renovations at Winona and Moorhead, the classroom additions at St. Cloud Tech, and partial funding for system-wide science lab renovations. We believe that the funding overall for higher education bonding projects in the governor's budget were woefully inadequate. I just completed a visit to three different states in other parts of the country, and what they are doing does put our efforts as woefully inadequate. We are pleased that both the Jobs and Economic Development Committee recommended the University Mayo Clinic Bioscience Initiative and statewide bioscience initiatives as higher priorities. We are also pleased that the House Higher Education Committee has recommended to rearrange some of the governor's recommendations and to provide more funding for higher education. On the University of Minnesota Mayo Bioscience effort, I've been very active on the governor's Bioscience Council. The recommendations and responses to those recommendations are extremely important to our state's continued leadership in the medical technology bioscience industry. The convergence of medical device and biotechnology is where R&D must head for the next highly competitive steps in that industry. An example of that potential is the recently approved by the FDA drug-coated stent produced by Boston Scientific. 2 weeks ago, Boston Scientific on Thursday was approved by the FDA to sell the drug-coated stent of theirs. In the next 5 days, actually two business days, they shipped $100 million worth of stents. The capability of the industry to be very impactful back into the state is quite amazing. The availability of excellent research facilities and educational facilities are critical to Medical Alley's diverse membership. One of the major reasons the device industry has thrived in Minnesota is because of the availability of a highly trained workforce. In order to address workforce needs and research demands, infrastructure needs must be addressed at both the University of Minnesota and the Minsku campuses. Currently, we are experiencing shortages in areas of nursing, allied health professionals, biology, and engineering. We are pleased to see that the requests of both systems addressed those priorities, and more specifically, we hope you will find the following we will fund the following projects in addition to those already named. One, the classroom renovations at the Academic Health Center. We are pleased to see that this ranked as a second priority for the House Higher Education Committee. The governor did not include the Academic Health Center in his recommendations. These classrooms are over 25 years old and as presently configured do not respond to the changes in healthcare education. Most classrooms are large, old lecture halls. Smaller classrooms are now needed for more flexible learning, critical to maintaining a world-class education system for our healthcare professionals. Two, $121 million of Minsku's bonding request would fund science labs or classrooms for nursing and allied health professionals. The governor only funded 13 of the 32 requests. Many projects would address the critical needs for expanding nursing and providing more science classrooms and laboratories. If Minnesota is going to continue as a center for bioscience, it is imperative that we have an educational system to support future scientists, engineers, and healthcare professionals. In particular, we think the legislature should fully fund the statewide request for science labs renovation and workforce training classrooms. In addition, science projects at Bemidji State University, Southeast Technical, Mankato State University, St. Cloud State University, and community colleges at Rochester, Minneapolis, White Bear Lake, and Austin all provide the needed infrastructure. We very definitely realize this is an ambitious list, but it's critical that more of these projects do receive funding. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you, Mr. Gerhardt. Are there any questions for Mr. Gerhardt regarding the medical projects that he was spoken of. Representative Kelleher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gerhart, you've got my attention. You visited three other states that are doing much more. Tell us a little more. Where did you visit, and what are they doing, and what sorts of things should we be doing more of?
I can't give you the exact dollar numbers, but I'll talk about the states. Arizona is just shy of $1 billion of what they are putting into research and academic capabilities, bringing both the research and academic closer to the businesses, and they're building an enormous science park on the north side of Phoenix. I was in Florida. Just for starters, they spent $600 or $700 million to draw a major research facility from California to Florida. That is just one instance of what's going on in Florida. I was in Michigan. In Michigan, while not organized nearly like as well as Minnesota in the medical technology side, the money that's going into the University of Michigan campus right now is somewhere around $800 million for their two new major laboratories and a new hospital.
Mr. Chair, if I could follow up. I think your testimony was excellent, and give us your assessment. You detailed the 8,000 jobs outlined in the last few weeks by existing companies here in Minnesota. What is the potential over the next few years?
The potential is substantially larger than that. If you look at the 520 manufacturers that are in the state, and I gave you some of the data, but if you do some of the multiples, the smaller companies out-employ the big guys. So take the 5 or 6, maybe the 10 largest employers that produce that $16 billion in sales per year. There are 510 underneath them that out-employ them, so the multiples are very substantial. The assumption can be made then that as the large ones grow, as they grow, the same multiples will happen to the smaller companies. So the trickle-down of jobs in construction, as in protein design labs right now, has Representative Mahoney, I believe, about 200 pipe fitters and steam fitters, a large group of them anyway. The construction jobs, the material jobs, all of that trickles down. We think this is really an estimate on just three or four of us putting our heads together. It looks as if that 8,000 to 10,000 jobs is minimum. And we estimate that's 5, maybe 7 years. But as you watch Boston Scientific is hiring 100 employees per month right now. That's going to ripple through the entire sector.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to say that Representative Mahoney is often at my office making me read things that I probably would never read without him bringing them to my attention. And I saw a document earlier in the session that the mid-range estimate, I think, was something like 20,000 jobs produced over a 10-year period by smart investment. And particularly, I think the question is, we are very interested in how to take things from the research level and put them into the development level, but my understanding is that is the unique job of what is government in terms of higher education investment to invest in those research level areas.
It is a combination. It's partly the research. The other part is we do not want to give the committee the impression that it is only PhD and only master's degree and PhD engineers. The full range from high school through two-year graduates, et cetera, are needed for this industry. It is a broad range. It does not deny anyone access. It is an absolutely wonderful opportunity for the state. I agree that 20,000 is probably a more accurate number, but I did not want to go beyond what I knew was going to happen.
Any further questions for the testifier? Well, thank you, Mr.
Thank you very much.
Members, just to let you know, we have to be out of this room by 4:30. We can't stay any later than that. And not to minimize your questions or anything like that or comments, but I just let you know that we've got about 16 other people who want to testify, and that in order to get through this list, we've got to keep our comments brief and to the point. So just as a reminder to you and to the people that come and testify that our time is going to be limited here. The next person that would like to come and testify regarding higher education is Ms. Twyla Braze, or Brazy. Welcome to the committee, and for the record, please state your name and the outfit that you represent.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Twyla Braze. I'm president of the Citizens Council on Healthcare, and here to talk about the research facility that is going to be funded sort of through the university, but at Mayo. The biotechnology industry promises to be a very new and burgeoning area of commerce. However, it is fraught with some ethical and socially difficult issues. Not dealing with these issues up front and at the onset of this endeavor is to threaten the potential of this industry in Minnesota. Genetics, genomics, and the sequencing of our DNA are some of those issues. This bill provides funding for genetic research building that will be used to facilitate the study of past, present, and future patients at both Mayo and the university. The public is generally quite wary of genetic research and particularly worried about such research being done without their consent. There have been big questions recently regarding the integrity of the research community in general. In Minnesota, the Parker Hughes investigation made front page news, and in California, we hear that the head of the cadaver research department was selling bodies for a profit. So I have three background items to share and one request. Minnesota law allows medical records research without patient consent if it is conducted by institutions that hold those medical records. These are known as internal researchers or researchers within the institution. Such research can include genetic research on the tissues, fingernails, serum, and body parts that patients leave behind as part of the testing that they had done or as part of surgery. For instance, we hear in the Star Tribune that Mayo has 10 million biological specimens in their repository going all the way back to 1906. For external researchers who want access to Mayo's medical records, for instance, if Harvard decided to go to Mayo and ask to have access to the records, and including the tissues, the Minnesota law does require patient consent, but that need only be in a general authorization. So that could be when you went to the hospital and you signed that you were willing to not only be treated, but there could be other things that could be on that general authorization. So it's not study specific and it need not mention genetic research. In addition, if the patient has not signed the consent form, external researchers, such as folks from Harvard, may send the request by mail asking for patient consent for the research. If the patient does not actively deny the request, perhaps they just throw it in the trash. Perhaps it never actually arrives to them. The researchers only have to send out the letter twice. If it doesn't come back to the researchers, it's considered implied consent. In other words, the consent has been given by the virtue of the fact that they never actually said no. So, according to an article written by a Mayo researcher, 18% of Mayo's consents are implied consent. Therefore, as you can see, state law does not require patient consent for genetic research. Neither does federal law or federal regulations. Neither one provide the patient with the right to decide whether or not they want to be part of a genetic research project. However, federal law does allow a stronger, stricter, more privacy-protecting state law to preempt it. Yet, as I have said, Minnesota does not protect against unconsented genetic research. So, our request is very simple. For medical research projects done in the proposed genetic research building, which is funded by state taxpayers, we simply want patients to be guaranteed the right of informed patient consent for genetic research. The consent should be study-specific, not just a general authorization, and it should be on a separate form that explains that the request could include research on their DNA and their genes. This will allow patients to ask the types of questions that they need to ask prior to agreeing to the research. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Braze. Any questions for Representative Mahoney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Braze. could you tell me, do other states require these kind of consent forms?
Ms. Brace?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney. Our state has the strongest, most protective law in the country having to do with medical research, and yet it doesn't allow that kind of consent that I'm talking about. It has several large loopholes. One, that if your tissue is in Mayo or the university, for instance, or your medical records, there's no consent necessary to use it. The other loophole is that if someone else comes in and wants to access it, although they have to ask for your consent, they don't actually have to receive it if they've sent out two letters. That's the best law that there is in the nation having to do with genetic research and medical research, actually.
Follow-up, Professor Mahoney?
I just want to make clear that we already have the best implied, the best patient consent laws in the nation. And your concern is that we don't have enough.
Ms. Braze?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, that is correct. Genetic research is, I remember Jeff Kahn, actually, who's at the Bioethics Center at the University of Minnesota. We were both on the same conference. He on one panel and I on another. And he said that he was at the airport and having his shoe shined. And the guy said, "So what do you do?" And he thought, "Well, okay, I'll just tell him." And he said, "Yeah, I do bioethics." And he said, "Like what?" And he said, "Oh, you know, like genetics." And the shoeshine guy said, "Oh, genetics. Oh, well, I don't ever want to have that done without my consent. That scares me." And he was surprised. Mr. Kahn was surprised that someone like a shoeshine guy would be concerned or even know enough about genetics to be concerned. Because it's fairly new. So.
Representative Mahoney. Okay. Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Braze, as you indicated, Mayo has millions of records and tissue samples and has had those for decades. Can you name me any time that there's been a violation of privacy?
Ms. Braze.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bradley. An actual violation that we know about? No. Violations that we don't know about? Who knows? There was an instance that one of the researchers at the university, when he goes around and he talks to other researchers, he talks about the time where a researcher decided that he wanted to study a particular, I don't even know what to call it, it was called P53. He wanted to study that because he thought that would be interesting. So he went to another researcher who had a database of fluid, blood, and decided to look for that particular thing in that blood. No consent, nothing. No one even knew about it. There was no really big deal. He found out there were 90 people, I think, of the 2,000 that he tested. Turns out several years later, other researchers in other parts of the country found out that P53 gave individuals a fivefold increase in having breast cancer. And now those researchers were in a dilemma. They knew that these individuals had been tested, but nobody else did. And they knew they weren't sure what to do because they hadn't actually gotten consent to test them. So what Mayo has done, we don't know. What we'd like to do is make sure that patients have the opportunity to give consent before their tissues are tested genetically.
Follow-up, Representative Bradley?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. The answer is that there's never been an incident where anybody's had a complaint about privacy. The other thing that I wonder, Ms. Braze, if you understand the impact on the epidemiology and research that would occur if we took the extreme approach that you do, and that is, I mean, this is an extreme life-saving kind of things in which they're very low incident, and if you don't have high incident of participation, then you have no statistical way to do the kind of breakthroughs in healthcare that occur because of Mayo and I think other places, large databases and these kind of involvements. I would also sort of add to that it's one thing to sort of hypothetically try to scare, but in the other, to really talk to people about research use, and I've made it a point to try to talk to people. When I heard anybody who who understands when it's for research use that's protected, that's a problem, really. So I guess my concern, maybe I'll just put it in terms of, because I don't really need an answer, just to remind Ms. Braze that that you are walking on a thin line that could destroy the possibilities of important health care breakthroughs with what you're talking about.
Mr. Chair?
Ms. Braze.
Thank you, Mr. Bradley, or Representative Bradley, for that those thoughts. However, we really believe that the integrity of the research industry and the hospital system itself needs to be preserved by understanding that patients come first and that patients' rights need to be protected. Furthermore, many, many people are very, very willing to be part of research projects, but most all of them want to be asked. And actually, Mayo has a very high percentage that agree, although the forms that I have seen have never asked about genetic research, so that would be somewhat interesting. And Marshfield Clinic has a 9-page consent form to do DNA testing that they are getting people to agree to. So we also look at the fact that we have progressed greatly in medical research without accessing everybody's information, without their consent thus far. So,
thank you, Ms. Braze. Representative Stang? Any further questions for the witness? If not, thank you very much for coming and presenting.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Solberg.
Not for the witness, but for somebody in the committee. This project is listed under DEET, I think. Is it now supposed to be under the University of Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, it's under the University of Minnesota /Mayo Clinic Biotechnology on page 23.
Yeah, but
that's in the section economic development, employment and economic development.
Right? My question is this now part of the university's request, or is it still the convoluted request of DEET getting it and then giving it, and don't worry about one-third debt service and so forth?
Yes.
Okay.
The next testifier is coming up together, Peter Lindstrom and Dick Schwartz. Welcome, gentlemen, and if you could state your names and the outfits that you represent.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Peter Lindstrom. I'm the manager of public affairs for the Minnesota High Tech Association. And we will be brief. We have already distributed a letter in support of 5 specific projects at the University of Minnesota. And those projects are the Academic Health Center Education Facilities, Carlson School Expansion, Education Sciences Building, Kolthoff Hall Renovation, and the life science renovation on the Duluth campus. I have with me Dick Schwartz, who's a small business owner and a member of the Minnesota High Tech Association, and I'll let him explain the importance of the University of Minnesota to the technology industry here in Minnesota.
Welcome, sir. If you could state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Richard Schwartz. My wife and I are the owners of First Light Communications, which is a small information technology consulting business based in New Brighton. I'm here today as a representative of the Minnesota High Tech Association in support of the University of Minnesota's bonding request. The MHTA is the largest high-tech trade association in the state, with more than 200 members who contribute to the growth, success, and sustainability of Minnesota's high-tech economy. Minnesota has a lot to be proud of when it comes to the high-tech industry. More than 135,000 people are employed in the high-tech sector. Numerous technological innovations that have changed the way we live and work were invented here in Minnesota, from mainframe computing and access to the internet to countless medical devices and drugs. Minnesota ranks in the top 20 in nearly every technology industry sector. We didn't make these achievements by accident. Much of what the state has accomplished is because of the University of Minnesota. university is an economic engine that drives our technology industry through its research and its graduates. 98% of the research in Minnesota higher education occurs at the University of Minnesota. The research completed at the U often is turned into products that are sold by Minnesota businesses. I heard this morning that more than 1,200 companies have been spun out of the Institute of Technology at the university alone. Currently, over 6,000 undergraduate and graduate students are enrolled in the university's Institute of Technology. These highly qualified students leave the university prepared to work for Minnesota companies, and a large percentage of them actually stay in Minnesota. It is important for technology companies that the students they hire are exposed to some of the best professors in the world and the latest technologies in the classroom. The money spent today pays off in technology advancements that change the way we live and work in the future. Amongst these are fast and small computers, new breakthroughs in telecommunications, biotechnology, and advanced manufacturing, drugs and medical devices that save lives, and equally important, the money pays off in educating future business executives that can turn a great piece of research into a great business. These are but a few examples. From a somewhat more personal perspective, I've had a long-standing relationship with the university dating back to my undergraduate days several years ago. Since then, I have served in several different voluntary capacities at the university. As a former board member of the Institute of Technology Alumni Society, as an industry advisor on curriculum development committees, as a mentor to Institute of Technology students, and as a lifelong learning student who still occasionally takes a course when circumstances permit. This service has given me an opportunity to have close association with many of the undergraduate and graduate students who will benefit from these infrastructure investments that are in the university's request. Because of this association, I've become keenly aware of the needs of the university and the dreams and aspirations of many of these students who are the next generation of scientists, engineers, and mathematicians. We owe it to them and to ourselves to invest in the University of Minnesota because it is true that the contributions that they make will affect all of our lives. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schwartz. Thank you, Mr. Lindstrom. Any questions for the testifiers here? Representative Solberg.
Just very quickly, thank you. And I guess I can understand the Minnesota High Tech Association Council supporting most of those proposals. But tell me why you as a high tech association also have included the Carlson School expansion in that list. As I look in the book and look at that, that's not very much high tech associated. It's MBAs and business people, and I know you guys like to have business people, but I would think your interest would be in the high tech industry.
Mr. Lindstrom or Mr. Schwartz?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, you're absolutely right. It's not a natural fit for the High Tech Association to support the expansion of the Carlson School. But as Mr. Schwartz indicated, oftentimes or sometimes you have great research that just sits there because you don't have the business acumen to develop it into a great business. So when we were looking at all of the different requests from the university, this one stood out as one that should be supported.
Mr. Chairman, just let me read a sentence here. It says additional technology-rich classrooms are needed to accommodate the increased enrollment in Carlson School programs and to serve the College of Liberal Arts, which is kind of, I could understand if it was a College of Technology or the IT, but I'm just kind of struck me as a little curious that the High Tech Association is concerned about liberal arts. I'm pleased with that, but it's not much of a fit. Unless, of course, you want to sell lots of high-tech stuff to the University of Minnesota, isn't it? And it's a fit.
Further comments, further questions for the witness? If not, Mr. Lindstrom, Mr. Schwartz, thank you for testifying today, and we'll be taking these subjects up later on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The next next area of talking points will come in the area of transportation. Mr. Tim Werke. Mr. Dennis Hagberg. Maybe Dennis is here. Looks like they're coming forward. Mr. Werke, Representative Hausman.
Mr. Chair, just before we get into the projects, I think you and Representative Tingelstad can bear me out on this, but if you look at how our recommendations, the Department of Transportation recommendations, were listed on this spreadsheet we got, I think there is a misunderstanding here. We forwarded six recommendations in a package.
Correct.
And then we voted individually on a number of others. And those those that passed, we sent on.
Correct.
But these are labeled here as neutral. So I think to be accurate, we would have to say there was a positive vote.
Correct.
Some were unanimous. Others were divided voice votes, but we might just want to at least make that observation for the sake of understanding of the committee, that the word neutral, at least from my perspective, doesn't quite describe the action of the committee.
Correct, Representative Hausman, you're right in the fact that the six main projects that are listed on our recommendation were a positive thing that we were coming for recommending for that, and the other ones that came for were on a, could be a 6-5 or 6-2 or whatever vote. It was, they were recommended, but they all were not a unanimous, necessarily unanimous as the first six were.
And I think even some of them, I recall Forest Highway 11, I'm fairly sure, was a unanimous vote.
Correct.
So, but the point was they were just voice votes.
Correct.
But they were, all of those were positive votes. So we just for the sake of the understanding of the committee, you might want to be aware of that.
Thank you.
Mr. Werke, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, good afternoon. My name is Tim Werke. I'm the director of the Highways and Transportation Division of the Associated General Contractors of Minnesota. Appreciate the opportunity to be here before you today, and I intend to be very brief in my remarks. Associated General Contractors of Minnesota is the state's oldest and largest trade association, representing the interests of over 400 highway, heavy, and general building contractors. We are the contractors and material suppliers who will build the investments you're considering making today. Mr. Chairman, the AGC has been and continues to be an active member of the Minnesota Transportation Coalition. The coalition represents a broad-based spectrum of interests whose goal has been to enact a long-term multimodal transportation investment strategy for Minnesota. The following principles have been supported by the coalition members with respect to the 2004 bonding bill. At least 25% of the bonding bill should support multimodal transportation investment needs. Priority should be given to a balanced package that funds transit and local road and bridge projects that have regional and statewide significance. All transportation projects should be included in the bonding bill and should not be considered separately. The Associated General Contractors of Minnesota is appreciative of the funding levels reflected in the recommendations before you today, but we urge you to try to do more. The needs of Minnesota's aging infrastructure are well documented, and when combined with the projections of long-term metro population and travel growth trends, we are today at the dawn of seeing transportation's version of a perfect storm. The $850 million package passed during the 2003 legislative session represents a good start toward addressing the small portion of overall statewide needs, but that package only addressed the most pressing needs on the higher level state trunk highway system, and it effectively ignores the needs of the local road and bridge networks. The investments you are considering today are a small but very necessary step in addressing the entire spectrum of statewide system needs. Finally, let me be clear in stating that the AGC member firms are fully capable of delivering the investments you are considering today. Our member contractors have significant excess capacity to deliver an even greater number of transportation projects on top of the record levels of investment that will occur as a result of last year's $850 million bonding package. Additionally, the Federal Highway Administration estimates that for each $1 million of new investment in Minnesota's transportation system, 47.5 high-paying skilled jobs are directly created in our state. We therefore urge you to increase the transportation funding levels in this bill to reflect at least a commitment of 25% of the overall bonding bill total. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I stand for any questions.
Mr. Werke, your organization supports first of all, let me ask, where did your organization come up with 25% of the bonding bill? Was that just sort of a got together and a couple of beers and decided 25 was a good number? How'd you come up with 25%?
Mr. Chair, I don't purport to be the spokesperson for the coalition. However, I can tell you that we've had numerous meetings and we've discussed that issue at great length. In fact, the goal is 50%. But at a minimum, we would like to see at least 25% being reflective of what the needs are on the system, on the local systems. And the number, I think, is an inclusive number to try to represent those needs across highways, roads, bridges, transit systems, and the like.
Out of the governor's recommendations, what would you suggest to this committee be either reduced or eliminated in order to meet that goal?
Mr. Chair, may I clarify? Do you mean with respect to the balance of what is not transportation related in the bonding bill? Is that your question?
According to my calculations, the governor's recommendations do not have 25% transportation funding. So what is it, in your estimation, that this committee would do to, what should we either reduce or eliminate in order to try to reach what your organization feels is an appropriate amount of bonding?
Mr. Chair, I within the scope of the transportation projects, we would not have a comment on that. We would like to see the deliberations be inclusive, to be focused on a broad discussion of multimodal interests, not just all of the investments, for example, placed in just roads or all of the investments placed in just transit. Is that the question you're asking?
No, I'm asking, okay, you stated that 25% of the bonding bill should be transportation needs, transportation related. In the governor's recommendation, it's not 25%. So, should we forget about the biosciences? Should we heard from Red Lake earlier today. Should we zero Red Lake? What should we cut out of this bill in order to put more money for transportation in?
Mr. Chair, that's what I thought your original question was. That's a difficult question, and it's an issue that I think, as policymakers, you have to consider. From our organization's or from our coalition standpoint, we realize that transportation investments are in competition with these other pressing needs. I cannot give you an answer in terms of what the coalition would say with respect to that. I don't think we have taken an issue on that. We are simply advocating for transportation needs and not advocating against other needs that the state may have.
Mr. Werke, in every public survey that I've seen over the last year and a half, 2 years, when an open-ended question is asked of the respondents, transportation needs come usually somewhere 3 to 4% of the public believes that that's a priority. Every poll I've seen says less than 5%. That would include surveys done by the North Star Corridor Development Authority with regard to transportation in the what they claim to be is the fastest growing corridor in the state. So why is it that you believe that 25% of the bonding bill should be allocated to what the citizens of the state of Minnesota claim is somewhere less than 5% of them feel it's the top priority?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I guess I would answer that in the following from the following perspective, that the needs continue to grow, the needs infrastructure continues to age, and congestion in the metro area continues to worsen. Access to markets in greater Minnesota, pressure continues to build with respect to having sufficient infrastructure. By the time it becomes apparent that these factors are all converging on each other, that something needs to be done, we will be in a situation where we will not be able to respond immediately. It takes a significant amount of preparatory and development time in order to respond to those issues or those pressures. And I submit that once we arrive at that situation, we will be in that situation for a very long time.
So, Mr. Werke, the increasing needs of health care, the increasing needs of and costs of higher education, the increased needs of K-12 students, those are not a priority or not as high a priority in the estimation of your organization as those of building transportation infrastructure.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I would not say that from our perspective. I would say that those are all competing needs that need to be balanced, and that this committee's job, and I respect that, is to balance those needs and to deal with those tough issues. We are simply here today advocating for our share of those needs, and would hope that we would be treated in an equitable and fair manner.
Mr. Werke, I will try to get together the public polls that I've seen over the last 2 years and forward them to your organization. I don't think 25% as much is a realistic balance in terms of what this committee has to do. Representative Hausman.
I think he was arguing for a larger bonding bill. That's how I interpret those arguments.
Well, committee members, I think that the governor has stated, the Speaker of the House has agreed, and the majority leader in the Senate, that we aren't going to raise taxes. So I don't know where you're going to find the money for a bigger bonding bill if you don't want to raise taxes. It's pretty straightforward. And for every dollar we borrow, we have to pay back a dollar and a half over the next 20 years to pay off the bond. So get out. This is the credit card, folks. You got to pay it some point in time. So,
Mr. Chair,
Representative Mahoney, and then Representative Solberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you were speaking so quickly, and it went right by me. But I did hear that you were talking about job creation in your particular remarks. And if you could just repeat them to me, I can't remember, for X number of jobs for every million or whatever was spent.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Werke.
The figure that I was using comes from the Federal Highway Administration, the U.S. Department of Transportation. And they use this, a national statistic that for every $1 billion invested, that 47,500 jobs are created. I convert that to the Minnesota level, and we stand behind the figure that for every $1 million invested in the state, 47.5 direct construction-related jobs are created, which does not even account for the spin-off development-type jobs that would be created.
Representative Mahoney.
So the 40, the 47 jobs that you're talking about are directly are construction related. This bonding bill addressed that particular, your 25%. Bonding bill passes and everything, and we go sine die off to Never Never Land and on May 15th and or whatever it is, 17th. How soon could the Highway Heavy be in place to start the work? How long would it take?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Werke,
Representative Mahoney, it depends on a number of factors, with respect to the bridge bonding and other elements in the bill, I can't speak for that. You'd have to address the department in terms of the readiness of those projects, but my understanding would be that those projects are ready to go. My comments were geared towards the construction industry that we represent. Our members have responded to our surveying of them in response to last year's large package. Our members indicate that they have significant excess capacity in order to deliver any projects or any funding that's put into this bill. It is not a question for our members of whether or not they would be able to bid those projects or they would be able to do that work given the high level of construction that's currently going on in the state.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
Do you have any figures that how many times those dollars turn over in the local economy where those jobs are created?
Mr. Chair. Representative Mahoney, I don't have directly, I'm not that familiar with the economic side of things, but I would venture a couple of times.
Mr. Chair, I'll correct the witness. It's seven times as far as my favorite chair, excluding you, Mr. Chair, Bob Gunther, quite regularly talks about in his jobs and economic development that every dollar we spend generates, turns over seven times in its local economy. And I have one final question here. Mr. Chair, the witness, Governor's recommendation is $92 million. House recommendation is just under $130 million. So $130 million, I'm going to say that's 4,700 jobs that could be, 4,500 jobs that could be created rather quickly in your particular industry, and the turnover would be as I follow. But generally, if this bill passes, we're at minimum about 4,500 in the House recommendations, and if we went up, it's just from there. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I would concur with that, that those jobs in the construction trade construction trades would translate almost immediately.
Well, Mr. Chair, that sounds like a pretty good job program for a state in the midst of a recession.
Representative Mahoney, if we got rid of prevailing wage, we could get a lot more jobs and we get a lot more concrete. Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chairman, a lot less the standard of living for all of us, too. But maybe if we don't want to raise taxes, you know, I got a solution. I bet we could find a fee that we could raise someplace.
Would that be a gas pump fee?
Well, some kind of a fee. I don't care.
Well, Representative Solberg, I think that's up to the finance committees. I don't know that we can raise too many fees in the capital investment bill, but if you find some, let me know.
I knew you'd be really receptive.
I'm receptive. I'm receptive.
Well,
okay.
We got transportation in here. We can just have a pump fee.
They're a pump fee. Okay. Okay. If there are no more questions, thank you, Mr. Werke. Appreciate your testimony today. Next, we have Dennis Hegberg. To Washington County Commissioner. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner. Who's that guy you got with you there?
Just the guy they introduced with me.
So don't wreck the order, Representative Chair Green. Mr. Chair,
Representative Vanderveer.
We're here to testify in support of the Rush Line Bus Park and Ride project that was forwarded to this committee and recommended to it by the Transportation Finance Committee, and I have Commissioner Dennis Hegberg, my county commissioner of Washington County, here to explain the project to you.
Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, thank you for taking the time, and I know that your job is very difficult as you set the priorities of what you have to deal with. What I'm here for is I was out of town when the Transportation Committee here at the Rush Line Corridor's request, and it stayed in the bill. And I thank my good friend Ray here to do that. The Rush Line Corridor, which you have a sheet on, is a corridor that goes from St. Paul up to Hinckley. And we're a group of communities that have looked at the transportation needs of that corridor as we are growing very rapidly. And that corridor goes from includes individuals from many parts of the community, you know, Washington County, Pine County, as well as Ramsey County and Chisago County, and the cities of Forest Lake, Harris, Hugo, Little Canada, Maplewood, North Branch, Rush City, and White Bear, and the city of Wyoming, the township of White Bear. We meet on a quarterly basis primarily to discuss some of the projects that we need. And one of the projects was the is what we call the bus and ride parkways in many of the communities. As our communities grow, we need places for the individuals to park their cars and hopefully ride with one another, as well as bus transportation is being proposed in the city of Forest Lake. And we currently have some bus transportations up as far as Center City, no, not Center City, but over to the side of us in Anoka County. But we need to have also that transportation system come up to Forest Lake. Forest Lake, for instance, is one of the fastest growing communities. We issued more building permits in Forest Lake than Woodbury last year. And we're continuing to grow very rapidly. And that produces transportation problems along that corridor. The funds that we were asking for, the $1 million, will be used for the park and ride in Forest Lake, Maplewood, which is in Ramsey County, Rock Creek, but Pine County, Lent Township in Chisago County, which is on the corner of 17 and 35, and then Pine County has requested, what they're proposing is two vans to help the carpooling issues up in their area, then reducing the number of individuals on the highway. And as carpools and busing takes place, it increases the efficiency of our freeways and helps reduce the congestion. We also have a project that's called Unweave the Weave, which is in proposed 2005-2007, which will be a major construction project on 35E and I think it's 694. And anybody that's driven that now knows that that's a big bottleneck, and when we do the construction, it'll be a huge bottleneck. And we will need transportation mechanisms to help improve that efficiency during that construction time period. We do have the dollars from the federal, so your dollars will be the match to that. Are there any questions?
Committee members, questions of Commissioner Hagberg?
Mr. Chairman, just one quick question.
Representative Silver.
The federal funds, how long are they available?
I think we have to spend them by... Mike Rogers, my staff person, I don't want to say something and then find out it's incorrect.
Mr. Rogers, you just give us your name and your position for the record, please.
Yes, my name is Mike Rogers, and I am a transportation planner for Washington County. The federal funds have to be applied for by September 30th of this year. Otherwise, they would sunset.
Thank you.
Commissioner Hagberg, do you have any statistics as to what the growth in this corridor is, or where it ranks in terms of the congestion in the corridor?
Yeah, the in the corridor from I-35 corridor will increase by 25% from I-35 up to I don't know where that's at, but overall 65% between White Bear Lake and Hugo, and 50% north of Hugo. So with the growth that's taking place, that's a substantial amount. And Mike, I don't know, remember, that's a 20-year?
Yeah, that's over the next 20 years up to 2020.
Commissioner, do you know where this corridor ranks as far as other growth in other corridors?
No. I only care about my district.
My understanding, Commissioner, is it is contrary to... some of the disinformation that some other people have put out, it is the fastest growing corridor in the state.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time and your appearance before the committee. We appreciate your taking time to come down.
Thank you.
If you want validation of those numbers, Representative Tingelstad, talk to MnDOT. Next, members, we have Professor Anderson as well as Tim Miller. Myler, I'm sorry. And
Tom Myler.
I'm sorry, Tom. We sometimes have difficulties with these names, but anyway, Professor Anderson, and we have another Representative Olson. Do you want to give us a brief introduction while we're waiting for people to gather?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate you remembering my name, too.
I had to struggle with that.
Yeah. Waller, we have some technology to set up. This is going to be the fastest nonstop personal rapid transit presentation we've done so far. But I have a couple maps here I'll pass around while we're getting ready. They involve the plan for Minneapolis put forth by Councilmember Zimmerman. Mr. Chair, members, we're here to we're here to just as briefly as possible present for those who haven't seen this technology what it's about, the public safety certification facility that's proposed in House Bill 1686, and to identify the financing progress that has been made while we've been moving different bills through the legislative process. When we started, we were asking for a public-private partnership, state money, local money, as well as private funds of $8 million, totaling $24 million. We now have a document here from UBS Payne Weber to confirm and establish the PRT system as a bondable system. This is by the company that did the BART system in California and also the monorail in Las Vegas. And basically what we're waiting on is a confirmation for a project from a city, and we're also will be identifying the points of benefit from a state approval of a system like this so that investors know that we, in fact, will welcome this type of project and that they won't have to won't be making a major investment without any possible place to locate it. So that's the real essence of what we're pushing for with all the bills that we're moving forward, and that's just to simply identify that this is a viable technology. It'd be a welcome technology to add to our multimodal options that are that we're looking at and working with today.
Speaking of viable technology, Representative Olson, doesn't appear that the the technology that we have trying to put this presentation forward is very viable, but
yeah. Mr. Chair, we also have the old way.
That's right.
I see some notes here to my right from Tom Myler with Citizens for Personal Rapid Transit, and to make this, as I said, nonstop, as the technology is, the first fully automated, personalized, nonstop to your destination, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, fully mass-producible public transit system of its kind.
Let's,
with that, we'll go to Tom Myler from Citizens for Personal Rapid Transit.
Good, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Tom Myler, and I'm from Chaska. My five-second resume is I have a degree in electrical engineering, and I'm two classes short of an MBA in finance. I work as a computer analyst in the Bloomington-Edina area, just off of 494. I became interested in personal rapid transit a few years ago because I saw that it could be a world-class technology and a much better form of transportation. I became involved in Citizens for Personal Rapid Transit because I knew it was going to be a huge industry, and I wanted those jobs in the industry to stay in Minnesota. Citizens for Personal Rapid Transit's been around for about 12 years. We have about 200 members, another 1,000 or so on our mailing list. We are one of about 12 similar organizations in the United States. One of the things that we did last summer is we staffed an exhibit at the Wonders of Technology exhibit out at the State Fair. This was staffed all with volunteer labor. The volunteers came from the Twin Cities, St. Cloud, Rochester, Duluth, Mankato, Western Wisconsin, and as far away as Denver, Cincinnati, and Austin, Texas. Personally, I spent over 90 hours on the exhibit floor at the State Fair. Talked to literally thousands of people, and I had three people that wanted to argue with me over personal rapid transit and why it was not superior. Two of them just were skeptical, and they said, we want to see it. One was about a 65-year-old gentleman from Sweden who had worked in the rail industry for 40 years, and I just wished him good luck. I believe we talked to people nonstop from 9 in the morning till 9 at night. I spent 8 full days out there getting a minimal break for lunch. I think I'm the only person that was at the State Fair last year that actually lost weight. I can't prove that, but I think so. As we talked to these people, we decided we need to show some support, and so we decided to start a petition. We got over 4,500 signatures on a petition in less than 10 days. That's a phenomenal amount of signatures for people, many of which had never seen personal rapid transit. We had the vehicle, a prototype vehicle there with a 60-foot section of guideway. Every time that vehicle moved, we gave a ride about every 15 minutes. Every time, there was immediately a line going out the door to get a ride. It was the most exciting 45-foot, 4-mile-an-hour trip these people have ever been on in their lives. We also had a lot of visitors at the State Fair from around the country, also from Japan and Singapore, people that came for the sole reason to see this prototype. Personal rapid transit is a system that is going to attract riders. Consistently where I work, people come up to me and they say, when are you going to get that system in? Doesn't matter what time of year it is, summer, winter, what the weather is, they want another option. It's also the only system that's going to be economically sustainable. The fares are going to pay for the whole system. I look at personal rapid transit as a true investment for the state of Minnesota, an investment where there are going to be dollars returned to the state in the future. And with this, I urge you all to support the legislation and give this industry the gentle nudge it needs to get started. Thank you.
Let's, Representative Keller, if we just let Professor Anderson go through his brief presentation, and then we'll go to questions. Professor Anderson, welcome to the committee. Again, just give your name and your organization for the record, please.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, my name is Ed Anderson. I'm Chairman and CEO of Taxi 2000 Corporation, and for 23 years as Professor of Mechanical Engineering at the University of Minnesota, where we began to develop this technology. We have a movie. You see the movie already. What you see behind you is a good description of the system we're talking about, the system of small vehicles. Actually, each car has a seat wide enough to handle a wheelchair, and the cars run fully automatedly with between offline stations, which I'll describe a little bit more. With the technology today, we can handle about as much traffic as three freeway lanes, and I'll show you later. The land saving is enormous compared to a three-lane freeway. We use about 1/640th of the land. I think you see there pretty well how the system works, so I'll just continue with my presentation here. Have to cut that off. So we're talking about a major new industry. I'll mention what it is, who helped make it happen briefly, what are the benefits, and what are the training needs. First, the idea of the offline station is the key to a major breakthrough in transportation because it allows you to use the smallest possible vehicle, which allows you to use the smallest possible guideway. For example, compared to a train, our guideway weighs about 1/15th as much, and the size is only about a little less than 3 feet wide by a little about 37 inches deep. This allows you to get high throughput. It's sort of like a freeway where now the cars run actually in one line with a technology run about three times as many cars as a freeway lane. And by stopping offline, every trip can be nonstop, and adding more stations doesn't slow down the travel. All the trips are nonstop. There's very little waste. It's very simple to install. You excavate, pour a foundation, set a post, and away you go. Most of the parts, almost all the parts, will be made in factories. and extremely little disruption in installing a system like this. This is an example of a network. This happens to be downtown Minneapolis, a network that we've studied. The idea is that we have a switch with no moving parts in the guideway, so you can make nonstop trips. You can make a network of virtually any size. The network was studied by SRF Consulting Group. We estimated the cost would be a little less than $100 million. They estimated for a dollar fare, they get about a little over 3,000 trips. It actually is a positive return on investment. You could build and operate that system as a private concession for a profit. This system can attract enough riders to reduce congestion. There's no sacrifice in trip time compared to automobile. And in fact, in the downtown area, it'll get you there faster than by auto. There are no transfers, I mentioned, very short wait. Off-peak, there's no wait. Go 3 o'clock in the morning, goes immediately. You have you're seated in comfort, and it's secure. The stations are monitored so that you would have much less security problems than getting, say, into your car in a multi-story parking structure, and it's affordable. This system was spawned at the University of Minnesota, and because of coming out of the university with about 13 years of study before we built it, it's turned out to be the world's leading PRT. We've won three international competitions. I'd be glad to discuss them with you. Over $30 million in some money in sweat equity. For example, we had $1.5 million study with Chicago RTA and mostly volunteer help. The Minnesota High Tech Association sponsored us at the State Fair at the Wonders of Technology building. This is a scene, typically what it looked like there. It's over 900,000 people that visited us. Knutson Construction Company, they made our platforms, moved the whole system to the fair and back without charging us at all. Honeywell gave us a budget of $10,000 to defray our expenses. They're going to do the details of the operational control system. We had a small group of people, actually only about three people, that managed the project. There were 68 private investors that invested over $800,000 in the year 2002 that made it possible. We had over 60 volunteers, mostly from Citizens for PRT, and 18 Minnesota companies that helped contribute one thing or another to building it. This is a list of the companies. Short Elliott Hendrickson is the largest transportation planning firm. Knutson, you're very familiar with. Kretsch Ogard is a Duluth company, and so on down the list. The major benefits of this kind of system are congestion reduction and also land saving. I can illustrate it here. This is the three-lane freeway on the left side. The fourth lane is an acceleration lane. Now, here's the people, and yeah, notice there are about 6,000 cars per hour in three lanes. Here's the people in the cars. The rush hour average in Twin Cities is only 1.08 people per vehicle, so occasionally you see two, and back there somewhere three. Suppose you can move these people in the middle and put them in three PRT cars, or PRT cars. Actually, we would put the guideways on the fence line, but the point here is that we reduce from width of 300 feet to 15 feet. That's a 20-to-1 reduction. We do better than that because all we need land for is a post and station. So you can do something with the land, hiking trails or whatever below. You don't interfere with cross traffic, so the system is far safer than any conventional system. So the price of the elevated guideway is an enormous reduction in land needed for transportation and much higher level of safety. You can, in some streets where you have trees on each side, you can run the guideway supported on arch supports and run it down right down the middle. More benefits. Here's a bunch of benefits. Lower accident rates, four times the energy efficient the automobile, and so on. No road rage in the system. And you don't need a driver's license. As you get older, many communities, you well know, there are people that shouldn't be driving but do because they don't have a choice. You can attract many auto drivers with this kind of a system. This is a major breakthrough in transportation once this comes. And this is hard to believe, of course, that it came from here. It didn't come from the other side of the world. The next step to do this is what we call a safety certification facility, which is a 2,200-foot oval track. It's about a 24-month program, but this will allow us to run vehicles continually and get ready for commercial applications. We need it to get it ready for public use, to compete in the world market, and to train planners and engineers. This will be a training facility as well as a test facility. Why in Minnesota? Well, to increase employment in high tech. People talked about that. To provide a cost-effective solution to many problems. We have been the world center in this research. We are considered the world leader in it, and will continue to be if we can keep this program going. And there's a new source of revenue for a number of people in Minnesota. And why now? Because the technology is ready. We have the team of suppliers ready to go, and there are people nipping at our heels. These are three other projects around the world which would like very much to take the lead from us. So passing this bill, 1686, is a much-needed signal to private investors that the state of Minnesota recognizes PRT as a much-needed enhancement to our current transit systems and will welcome its advance, whether public or private. This is the key factor needed to get this technology going. We can be the major center of a new high-tech industry. If you haven't been out to our facility to see it, we urge you to come. Hennepin County, a commissioner mentioned Monday that coming out to see it made a huge difference for him to actually see it and feel it. It's the end of my presentation.
Thank you, Dr. Anderson. Representative Kelleher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Olson, did you say that farebox credit is going to be used as one of the financing mechanisms in terms of securing the bonds then?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kelleher, I didn't speak to that particular question, but that would certainly be considered by the bond company in calculating how they would finance it, in respect that one component that they're waiting for to finalize any proposal, as I understand it, and I'll certainly want Professor Anderson to speak to this more if I'm not correct, but they're waiting for a city to confirm they want a project. As there's progress going on in Minneapolis, as you know, and from that get a ridership study, because that's what would tell us the farebox return and further tell us how to best finance it and how they would package the financing end of the whole project.
And Mr. Chair, members should just be aware that it is challenging in the words of UBS to market given the narrow revenue stream and the industry's history of deficit operations. So I think we need to be very aware that this is tricky in terms of farebox revenues. But I also want to ask you, Representative Olson, who is going to own the technology involved in PRT? I've talked to some folks in the city of Minneapolis who believe that they will be partial owners in this technology if they're moving forward. And I think I heard earlier in the year that that is not the case. That's not the understanding of those of you advocating for this. So if the public invests in this technology, are they going to get the return on their investment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kelleher, one of the last slides you just saw had to do with the point of whether it's publicly or privately funded. The state would welcome this. The product public safety certification and trainings facility is a facility that if it involves any state bonds will be owned by the state. Okay? The systems could be owned privately or they could be owned publicly. In another bill that I have moving through the process, House Bill 1650, and I think in also 1687, it references public or private ownership. I in no way simply advocate only private ownership, but simply, you probably hear an emphasis to that and are attentive to that very well, because this is the first system that shows promise of being able to be privately funded and basically restore what we once had, and that was privately funded transit systems from territorial days till about 1940.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Keller.
I am, as one, am not particularly interested in investing a system that the public does not own, both the facility and the technology involved in running these things. I think that that is a recipe for disaster. I don't know what good the $24 million track is to us if we don't have some investment further in that. And beyond that, I am still quite skeptical of the understanding that the investors have of what it means to have state investment, state bonds invested in their project. And until that can be remedied, I'm not sure this thing's ready for prime time.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Olson.
Representative Kelleher, I can appreciate your concern about having a state-funded project. It can go either way. I hope you would not take away the rights from other communities to have a privately funded project if that's what they so desire and if private investors are willing to come forward and provide that, because it saves an awful lot of burden on the area taxpayers when that occurs. And that's really the point here, is making that available. If you want to advocate in Minneapolis for a state-funded system, that's great. More power to you. Both options are on the table. I don't know all the details behind what you're reading, and I think it'd be good for us to look at what you're referencing there so that we know it's being presented properly. Because I just saw that document today, and it basically represents what I said is a confirmation that this is a bondable project, albeit the concern of finding a city, emphasis added, just trying to restate myself so you understand what I did say, and for other members to understand it as well. We need a city to say yes, put forth the plan, it could be the one we just saw, identify the ridership, and that's what will absolutely confirm it. Once we know that the numbers are there for the ridership to produce the returns, the numbers we have so far show that. Those folks are convinced enough of that that they put forth that much of a document.
Representative Olson, you're losing money. Remember, the time is money in this committee, and as the time drags on, the money goes down.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the skepticism.
The two of you, you're both here on a fairly frequent basis. You can have extended conversations. We have other people who are here to testify, so we'd like to have you summarize, if you would, please.
And to your point, Mr. Chair, in the summary, I understand the long list we have that goes beyond what we can put in the bill. And that's one of the reasons why we wanted to come forward today and confirm and bring forth that document, openly share it with people, and identify that we aim to lower the cost of the project as we wanted to do all along, looking at the $2 million that the Transportation Finance Committee put in their list of recommendations. Anything like that would be a real godsend to keeping this technology in Minnesota where it belongs, right where it started. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Hausman. To these individuals?
Yes, are the 68 investors public information? Is that something that we could see?
Professor Anderson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hausman, I'll have to check with my lawyer on that. I don't think it's proper for me to answer without legal advice on that. Okay. But they're private individuals, mostly around, but they're not only in the United States, but a number of other parts of the country, like Seattle, Cincinnati, Washington, D.C., New York, from quite about, but they're all private individuals.
Mr. Chair, I'm not one of them.
Thank you. I'm sure, based on the questions, that the committee members won't want to not own the right-of-way and not be able to be public operations of any transit system. So thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next, members, we have Carol Lovereau from the Association of Minnesota Counties.
Thank you,
welcome
Mr.
to the
Chair.
Committee.
For the record, my name is Carol Lovereau. I'm the Transportation Policy Analyst for the Association of Minnesota Counties, and we're here to discuss with the committee the bonding recommendations for local bridges and local roads. We're very appreciative of the transportation policy's recommendations to this committee. They met two of AMC's legislative bonding priorities for local bridges and local roads. However, they didn't quite go as far as we had hoped. And I distributed a list of all the local bridge projects that have been submitted by resolution to the Office of State Aid at MnDOT.
This is in your packets,
yes.
Members.
And it lists all the projects that are ready for construction in 2004 and 2005. And at the current time, they total over $84 million. And these are deliverable projects in the coming 2 years. The counties are committed to doing and delivering to the constituents that they serve. For the local road improvement program, we had recommended $125 million, and we had divided that up into three accounts. Currently, the local road improvement program has two accounts, an account for what we consider roads of regional significance, and another account called Trunk Highway Corridor Account. And the committee recommended $20 million for the roads of regional significance and $10 million for the Trunk Highway Corridor Count. And we also were advocating this year for a new account to address rural road safety, and that would be a Minnesota Rural Road Safety Account. And we were advocating for $50 million for that, $50 million for the roads of regional significance, and $25 million for the Trunk Highway Corridor Count. As you heard in earlier testimony, local roads have not received any significant transportation funding increases since the last gas tax was passed in 1988. And we don't see a significant transportation funding proposal on the table this session either. So in order to address our urgent needs, we felt compelled to come forward with these bonding recommendations to help us try and address some of our critical needs on our local roads and bridges. And I would be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Erdahl.
So thank you, Mr. Chairman. Madam, I read that $70 million leverage with federal money that's available would fix every rural bridge in Minnesota, excluding Sauk Rapids. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, it would address the list of bridges that you have. It wouldn't address every bridge in Minnesota, but it does leverage federal and state funds as well as our local match.
Okay, thank you.
So if I can just try to add some clarification for members, you said that the AMC's requested or the desired amount was $125 million for local roads?
Okay. That's correct, Mr. Chair.
And with that number, are those all current projects that could be done in the next 2 years?
Mr. Chair and members, during the last few years, we have submitted to the Transportation Finance Committee a list of road projects totaling over $900 million that are ready to go if the funding became available. So, yes, we could spend the money and deliver those projects.
And the Transportation Committee's recommendation was $20 million. For local roads, and with regard to local bridge improvements, clarification, you said that the AMC's recommendation is $70 million?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
And the Transportation Finance Committee's recommendation was $45.
Yes, that's okay. Correct.
Let me ask you, what is your position with regard to the numbers, other than obviously you believe that the numbers from the Transportation Finance Committee are too low, but what about the distribution of dollars between local road dollars and local bridge dollars?
local bridges are our number one priority because those are critical links to the rest of the transportation system. They are AMC's number one top priority.
So you do agree that putting more money into the local bridge funding is a higher priority than putting money into local road funding?
That would be our preference, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate it very much. If there are no further questions from committee members, we'll continue down the list. Next, we'd like to hear from Margaret Donahue, the Transportation Alliance. Welcome to the committee. If you'll just give us your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you. I'm Margaret Donahoe with the Minnesota Transportation Alliance, and I do have a handout if I could get it.
Certainly. We have a page. We'll help.
Thank you. The Minnesota Transportation Alliance is comprised of over 270 member organizations from around the state, representing the construction and engineering industries, labor, counties, cities, and advocates representing all modes of transportation, including roads, transit, air, rail, and waterways. We appreciate this opportunity to comment on the recommendations of the House Transportation Finance Committee. We appreciate the work done by the committee in putting together a balanced multimodal package of bonding recommendations. Our members would urge the Capital Investment Committee to maintain this approach and recognize the interconnected transportation system that is needed in order to move people and goods, which is the backbone of our state's economy. We need improvements in all areas of our system: roads, bridges, transit, rail, and ports and waterways. Businesses rely on an efficient transportation system to ship products, and the quality of our infrastructure has a direct impact on business location decisions. The $136 million in general obligation bonds recommended by the Transportation Finance Committee is a good start. As has been mentioned, we have significant transportation needs, and as the Governor and Lieutenant Governor have stated, we're 20 years behind in meeting our transportation needs in Minnesota. The result has been an increase in congestion, an increase in the number of deaths on our roadways, and increased costs for businesses and commuters. With over 600 Minnesotans losing their lives every year in traffic crashes for the last decade, we believe it's time to take action this session to improve our county state aid roads to make them more forgiving and less deadly. As has been discussed, the need for local bridge funding, you've seen the list for $84 million, and also the need on the local road system. In the metro area, we're looking at an estimate of 650,000 new residents expected in the metro area by 2020, with only 23 new freeway miles planned. Investments in our transportation system will not only create jobs immediately in construction and design work, but an improved infrastructure will generate more economic development opportunities and activity. Investments in transportation will enhance commerce in the state, improve safety for Minnesota residents, relieve congestion, and reduce unemployment both now and for years to come. We've put together a list along the lines of the House Transportation Finance Committee that adds up to $188 million in general obligation bonds. Our members believe that this is the minimum investment that we need to have in our transportation infrastructure. And it does represent, as has been said, projects that are ready to go and could be delivered in the next 2 years. As we watch the state focus on implementing tax-free zones and other incentives to try and create jobs, we'd like to echo the comments made by Lou Dobbs in an article in U.S. News and World Report, who said that if the goal is job creation, aren't there more direct measures that lawmakers should be considering? If we're trying to create jobs, let's create jobs. Our roads, highways, and bridges are in sore need of repair. Investing in our infrastructure would definitely create jobs and would immediately stimulate the economy, and the investment would be lasting. Thank you.
Ms. Donahoe, the You have a list here that you presented us. As you said, totals $188 million. Is this list in a rank priority as far as your organization is concerned?
No, it is not in a strict priority order, no.
Okay. Are there any questions? If not, thank you, Ms. Tunnell. Appreciate your testimony and the information. We appreciate your coming before the committee. Next, we have Carolyn Jones, Minnesota Chamber of Commerce.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Carolyn Jones. I'm here today representing the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, as well as the Minnesota Transportation Coalition. The Minnesota Transportation Coalition comprises of over 220 organizations, including business, labor, local chambers, environmental groups, and representatives from highway and transit industries. The coalition over the past several years has worked to try and increase our investment in our overall transportation infrastructure. Our proposals have addressed both investment and efficiencies. The coalition's number one priority for this year in this session is to attain a goal of at least 25% of the bonding bill for transportation. We believe that priority within this should be given to multimodal projects that have regional and statewide significance. If you look at the overall purpose of bonding in our state, it is really to support our state's infrastructure needs. And the coalition believes very strongly that our transportation infrastructure is as important as our building infrastructure. If you look at other states, many other states have significantly greater percentages within their bonding bills than what Minnesota has had. If you look at Colorado, for example, 50% of their bonding bill by tradition goes for transportation needs. The coalition established a set of principles of projects that could be included in meeting this 25% goal. And we are happy to see that the projects put forward by the Transportation Finance Committee all meet those principles. We feel that the 25% is a very attainable goal. In fact, actually, if you look at what the chair of this committee's overall goal for a funding level for a bonding bill is, and you take 25% of that, the Transportation Committee's recommendations are almost aligned perfectly in meeting that 25% goal.
How do you know what the number is that the chairman is looking at trying to reach?
In reports, Mr. Chair, in reports that have been discussed about what the goal or the chair has said would be a figure that he would consider for an overall bonding bill.
Well, 25% of zero is still zero, so it's a heck of a...
Well, we've done pretty well then.
I can agree with that number. Okay, anyway.
The mic in your office.
I think, now speaking just for the chamber, improving our transportation infrastructure has been one of the chamber's top priorities for the past couple of years. And reaching this goal is very important to our members. And I think actually this is the first time I've had the opportunity to speak before this committee. And I think that's in part because the chamber, the state chamber anyway, really has never had in recent years a request in the bonding bill. And I think the request that we have before you today and the goal of trying to reach 25% really shows how significant our members feel that and how important that is in our for our membership. So I would encourage members of this committee to look at transportation, view it in the context of our overall infrastructure needs, and weigh those in priority with our building infrastructure. And try and reach this 25%. Thank you.
If I could ask Ms. Donahoe to come back up, because I didn't think it was fair for me to ask the question of Ms. Jones and not ask the same question that I asked earlier of Mr. Werke from the Associated General Contractors, and that is this currently with what we have in discussion is the governor's recommendation. We, of course, now have recommendations from the finance committees, but where would you suggest that we reduce, or do you have any suggestions maybe to reduce other areas of this bonding proposals in order to achieve a 25% proportion for transportation needs? Toss up question, you can, who wants to go first?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that, as I just stated, the chamber really feels that the 25% for transportation and the 220 members of the coalition have all stated that transportation is their number one priority. We do not have any other proposals, and I'm speaking directly for the chamber, in front of this committee that we are supporting. And so our primary emphasis is to support that those transportation needs.
But no, I understand that. But the members of this committee, the members of the House, in trying to achieve a balance, if we concur with the 25% number, if you were on this side of the table instead of at that side of the table, can you give us any suggestions as what do you believe could be potentially, I'm not asking you project by project, higher education, other economic development projects. We've got significant recommendations in the environment, natural resource area. We've got $20 million proposal for CREP. I mean, are there, I mean, somewhere in that, do you have some suggestions for these committee members as to trying to reprioritize the numbers to achieve your goal?
Well, Mr. Chair, if I think Ms. you can stab at it. Well, I guess our assumption anyway at looking at a possible 25% of the bonding bill would be to have a bigger bonding bill than what the governor is recommending. And I understand the discussion that's been here about not increasing taxes. But we are not trying to create a direct competition with other areas. We understand the needs are huge all over the state and in all areas of state government. Our proposal would be 25% of a $750 million bonding bill in GO bonds. And that would be our recommendation, is to make the pie bigger to meet the needs. And I don't know exactly how the legislature will provide for the debt service on those bonds, but I would, I guess, admit that a legislature that can solve a $4.5 billion deficit without raising taxes could probably be creative and find a way to pay the debt service on $188 million in bonds to meet our transportation needs.
The Ms. Donahoe, you handed us a list, the total $188, so if we have a billion-dollar bonding bill, do you think we should put more money in transportation needs in?
Well, the needs are certainly there, as has been indicated by the counties. The projects are there that could be delivered immediately for $84 million in bridges and $125 million in local roads. So that would be great to put more money into both of those areas.
Representative Hausman.
In fact, if you're thinking about a billion-dollar bonding bill, I think one of the things we'd all agree on very quickly is that 10-ton road system around the state that gets all those crops to market and builds our rural economy. There's another one to put on without a lot of discussion. Just since you raised it.
Well,
my mind is whirling.
Members, just if I had a nickel for every time someone has mentioned in the last year and a half the projects that were vetoed by Governor Ventura, and our project was in the bill, Governor Ventura vetoed it, I'd be much wealthier than I am now. And so if you want to come back in 2005 and say, well, My project was vetoed by the governor. I mean, I think we could put on the governor's desk $1 billion, maybe $1.5 billion dollar bonding bill, and we let the governor decide, just as the legislature did in 2002. Seems to me there were a lot of people around around the Capitol didn't particularly like the idea. The governor told us that he was going to do that. Governor Pawlenty has once again indicated what his level of bonding is. He feels is adequate. If we want to put $1.5 billion dollar bonding bill on his desk and let him veto it, then we can come back in 2005 and say, "Well, gee, this project was in the bill but got vetoed." So I really don't think that makes a whole lot of sense. But if that's what the committee and the legislature wants to do, we can wander down that path.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Yaros,
I have a solution. Let's just increase gas tax. Last time I bought gas, it was only 169 cents per gallon. I would add, I wouldn't mind paying another 30 cents. That's about 7.5 cents a liter. That would still make us at about half of, not even half of what the world market, what world price is. And it would be much more conservative and, cost-effective. It would be fiscally responsible because we wouldn't have to borrow and pay more. We would just, and transportation should be funded with gasoline tax. That's a user's fee. We shouldn't even call it.
I'd be happy. I'll talk to the advisor's office and I'll get a bill that we have a selection on the pump. It said if you want more money for roads, you get to pay a dollar. You get to pay another 50 cents a gallon. And you just, instead of selecting one of the, premium grades that's on the pump now, you can select another grade. It says 50 cents more per gallon right here. Same gas, just 50 cents per more. It goes into a dedicated fund. We all know that. So, I'll look for
50 cents last night.
Well, as I said, we can have that option. I'll get that bill drafted. Okay, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll pass. You ask my question. Thank you.
Representative Hausman.
Chair, can I just ask one more clarifying question since Ms. Donahoe is back up there? On yours, what is remind me, what is the corridor account that you're changing off the loans?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hausman, the corridor account is one of the accounts within the local road improvement program. Currently, there are two accounts. Last session, the legislature provided $20 million in bonds for that account, but the money is only available as loans.
Mr. Chairman, can I have a clarification on that? The corridor account is at the what they would say like 169 from Grand Rapids to Aiken. Is that a corridor?
Mr. Chair, the corridor account is an account that is designed to help local units of government with the local share of trunk highway projects.
All right. Thank you.
Ms. Jones, did you want to take another swing at my question, or we've had enough discussion as to where we might find some other, reductions or other, or do you also support, as Ms. Donahoe is speaking of, a larger bonding bill to accommodate additional transportation projects?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think speaking on behalf of the chamber, we would hesitate going beyond what the governor has supported in terms of an overall size of a bonding bill. But we continue to feel that within that range that we can support some of the transportation infrastructure needs in that. And again, I think as has been said, even with that 25% goal, we are just getting meeting a fraction of what is needed in terms of our overall transportation investments.
Thank you. Thank you both. Appreciate Ms. Donahoe, you coming back. And Ms. Jones, thank you very much for your testimony. Last on the list, we have Dennis Nelson and Martha Brand to testify regarding, are they together or are they're not together? Okay, well then we'll take ladies first. Fran, welcome to the committee. Again, for the record, please give us your name and who you represent.
My name is Martha Brand. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. Thank you for allowing us to testify. Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy is Minnesota's legal and scientific voice defending Minnesota's air, water, and wildlife. We are also part of the Transportation Coalition that has been referenced many times. MCEA supports a balanced system of multimodal transportation with adequate and secure sources of funding for public transit, and we also support the designation of at least 25% of the bonding bills to road and transit, and a 50-50 balance between roads and transit. On the transit side, we support the North Star Commuter Rail, Central Corridor, Cedar Avenue Busway, and Minnesota's participation in the Midwest High-Speed Rail Corridor. As an environmental organization, however, our focus is on public health and the adverse public health of continuing to focus transportation growth on highways and roads. Our conclusion is that transit increases make sense for both human health, the environment, and the economy of Minnesota. Adequate funding of the transit system consisting of viable bus and rail options would confer many benefits, including significant reductions in harmful air pollutants from motor vehicle exhaust. Air pollutants generated by car and truck traffic include particulate matter, ozone increases, and volatile organic compounds. The public health impacts linked to these pollutants include asthma and other respiratory illnesses, cancer, and premature mortality, particularly in the elderly. Children, the elderly, and people with asthma are at higher risk, and poor air quality can also impact function in healthy adults as well. Medical treatment for these health impacts can carry a significant financial cost, as the effects can be serious, sometimes resulting in hospital admissions and emergency room visits. In addition, the economic cost that would result if the Twin Cities region falls out of compliance with federal air quality regulations for ozones are considerable. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency reports that the metro area may exceed these federal air quality standards within the next several years. And as the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce testified in the Transportation Finance Division, the costs associated with non-attainment are $200 million annually to Minnesota's businesses. We feel that we owe it to Minnesotans to make the best decisions for public health, the environment, and the economy, and that a balanced transportation system with adequate funding for public transit will benefit us and our children and make Minnesota a healthier place to live. Thank you for the opportunity to present these views on behalf of the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy.
Ms. Brand, you've heard several organizations come before the committee today to testify that in their belief that 25% of the total bonding bill should be for transportation projects. Maybe you can't easily answer this, but do you think that that is an appropriate goal for this committee, or would you agree with their general statements or disagree?
My position that it is a goal for this committee to consider. I know that you have asked the previous people who have testified where would they pick between the competing demands. And my position is, or our position is, that public health and environmental health are two public policy criteria that should be considered when you're asked to make those difficult decisions. And I appreciate how difficult that is.
Ms. Brand, you also had the opportunity to see a brief presentation about personal rapid transit. Is that a type of transportation or a mode of transportation that your organization would likely support? I don't, or maybe you have a position, I don't know.
I have no comment on that.
Okay. Any further questions by committee members? If not, thank you very much, Ms. Brand. We appreciate your coming before the committee.
Thank you.
Last, then we have Dennis Nelson. Oh, I'm sorry. We'll take any Dennis we have left. Okay. We apologize, Mr. Larson.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
First of all, I don't represent anybody.
Well, hopefully you represent yourself. But
except
anyway,
myself.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Larson.
Thank you. My name is Dennis Larson. I live at 10541 Palm Street Northwest, Coon Rapids. And I live near the proposed North Star Foley Boulevard stop. And work in northeast Minneapolis next to the proposed North Star station near Central Avenue. And for entertainment, we get to watch the traffic on US 10 near the Foley Boulevard exit from our kitchen window. The reaction at work in northeast Minneapolis regarding the North Star project has been interesting. A location well served by bus lines operating nearby on both Central and East Hennepin Avenue. The North Star project seems to be positively viewed, and some say they are considering relocating along the line once it gets into operation. Although there are many options for bus transit, few employees I know currently use it. Those that do use transit have done so because of personal circumstances, usually loss of driving privileges for one reason or another. And most of the bus transit users live within a few miles of work, reverting to walking or bike riding in good weather. The Federal Transit Administration lists the average bus trip length in the Twin Cities at 4.1 miles. A surprise comment by several co-workers that complain about the traffic is where the traffic is most severe. Since I work close to downtown Minneapolis, one might think this is the problem area. But the area that seems to create the most frustration is 15 miles northwest of downtown at the new multi-million dollar spaghetti junction at US 10 and Foley Boulevard. And of course, we watch it. Two people I know got so fed up with delays that they changed shifts from days to the afternoon shift. One of my current supervisors, a 40-year employee who lives in the Princeton area, said his 51-mile commute used to take an hour. The en route delay stretched his drive time out to 2 hours. And another co-worker from the Big Lake area had similar experiences, and he took the same action, changing shifts to escape the traffic delays. Since a project of this magnitude is a first for the Twin Cities area, the main concern right now is understandably the initial capital expenditure. But I decided to look a bit further into operational costs instead. Initially, it seems the bus is really the most cost-effective. For $250,000, a bus service can be started. But like the real-life example I see every day, the bus isn't considered a viable option even though it is available. The cost per passenger mile nationally using bus service is nearly double that of commuter trains, 64 cents a passenger mile versus 32 cents for the train. Looking at several specific areas, I find that no matter how large a bus transit system is, there is little or no operational savings because of size. The New York Transit bus system, for example, shows a per passenger mile cost of 79 cents, and the Twin Cities is at 67 cents, while Duluth expends a dollar a passenger mile. The subway system in New York shows a passenger mile cost of 29 cents, and Metro North Commuter Rail is at 28 cents. Chicago gets similar results, 69 cents a passenger mile for the bus and 28 cents a passenger mile for commuter rail. Oddly enough, the most efficient system I found was San Diego's light rail system at 28 cents a passenger mile, and San Diego's population is nearly identical to the Twin Cities metro area. New commuter rail operations, such as the one in Seattle area, starting in the year 2000, began at $1.30 a passenger mile, but costs have fallen rapidly to 59 cents in just 2 years, lower than most bus systems in the United States. But the most important thing is the ability of a mode to attract riders for very long distances rather than only 4 miles, which is the Twin Cities average. A commuter train will have a much greater impact on congestion simply because passengers use it for much longer distances. The national trip length average is about 22.9 miles, and the quality of the service is high enough to entice people to park their automobiles. And I thank you.
Committee members, any questions? Mr. Larson, are you currently a transit user, or?
No. My route to work goes right past the Foley Boulevard stop. If I want to use transit, I can go downtown. I've got to change the bus, and I've got to come back out to Northeast Minneapolis, and I can make it in probably 45 minutes. Some days it would depends on the time of the day. Sometimes it would be an hour, hour and 10. The way it is for me, along with most other people, is that we just drive. It takes me 30 minutes, 25.
Okay. Representative Olson.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Larson, I apologize. I didn't get to hear all your presentation, but I've been curious about the you're talking about the rail proposal, right?
Right.
And I've struggled with finding evidence that it would, in fact, alleviate congestion. And you just made a comment I'm curious about on how a longer travel distance would help alleviate congestion. I can see where it might draw a few more people, given that it goes through a corridor that where everybody has to travel a greater distance. But if it still doesn't draw enough people, it still won't alleviate congestion. And the numbers that I've seen on some of the information given by the NCDA is that on the project, when it involved about 5,000 riders, it also involved bringing 6,000 new homes to the area. So that brings in more people than it's going to carry. And we're already one of the fastest growing areas of the state. Elk River Schools had about 700 new students just last year. Big Lake on one school had 300 some. And people are telling me all over we don't need more growth. And this is going to bring more growth, and it doesn't even carry the amount of people it brings. So I'm curious how it will alleviate congestion. Could you address that a little more?
Yeah, well, you have the Twin Cities bus system right now, 4.1 miles. Most of the trips are to downtown Minneapolis, from what I understand. And so their effort is in the inner city, core city. Like I mentioned, in our area, the congestion further out, 15 miles out, is actually much worse. And with North Star commuter train service, we can get through that. With a bus, you can't. I don't know if that answers your question or not, but I guess another way to put it would be if you're going to, somebody's going to go across the street and you're going to get them off the street some way, that's not going to have a big effect. But if he's going to be going across the town, the guy that, or the person that goes across town is going to put a much bigger load on transportation infrastructure than somebody that goes just across the street or 4.1 miles. And as I mentioned, the commuter train is a little over 20 miles. I am guessing, looking at the North Star system, it'd be much longer, probably be in the neighborhood of 30 miles. And the North Star system, of course, is going through areas that are congested much further out that you wouldn't expect would be congested, but they are. We watch them. We look at it right outside our kitchen window.
Thank you.
Mr. Larson, you said you currently don't take the bus to work because of the transfer and the time requirement. Would you likely, if North Star Commuter Rail was built, would you likely then use the train to get to work?
Absolutely.
Okay.
But that would mean for me would be the Foley Boulevard stop ever does get approved somewhere down the line. That means for me a walk or a short bike ride, or in some circumstances a short trip in the car. And I'd get to the station in Northeast Minneapolis and walk across the street. And one nice the difference between the bus system, I can go down Central Avenue, and the bus system is stopping every few blocks. I've been on these North Star demo runs, and from, say, Coon Rapids to Fridley, they operate at 79 miles an hour. The rest of it's kind of peaceful. It's in the 40 mile per hour range, and it's a nice ride.
Okay. If there are no further questions from committee members, thank you, Mr. Larson. We appreciate your taking time to come down and provide testimony before the committee. Members, if there's no one else who wants to provide any testimony,
is
there?
Our next meeting is?
Our next meeting is Tuesday. Regular scheduled time next Tuesday, committee members. So if no one else wants to come and provide testimony, committee adjourned. Thank you, committee members, for your patience.